This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Senator Barack Obama visits the White House. Governor Sarah Palin and her former running mate open up in interviews. And as protesters take to the street to battle the new ban on gay marriage in California, are Black Americans bearing the brunt of the anger? On today's Bloggers Roundtable, we've got self-described vigilante pundit Baratundi Thurston. He blogs for sites including The Huffington Post, Brandon Whitney, who runs the blog Homeland Colors, and Issa Yulin, the author of the novel Crystal Morning, who blogs at IssaYulin.com. Hi, guys.
How are you?
Hey, Farai.
So, there's plenty of news. First of all, you had President George Bush showing President-elect Obama around the White House, you know, measuring some curtains, all that. Baratundi, did this photo op slash tour help President Bush reenter the spotlight for a second? Because we haven't seen much of him.
I think we haven't seen much of him by design, and it's probably to his own benefit not to be seen too much. He's going to leave with lower approval ratings than Nixon, which is quite an achievement for a guy who had two terms in office. That meeting, to say the least, must have been very awkward.
Issa, do you think it was awkward, and not just in that meeting, but also the position where you have the transition, one of the first things that happened was that President-elect Obama started getting certain classified security information about threats to the United States. And so there's this kind of sunsetting process for one administration and this ramp up for another. How do you think it's going to go this time around? Because there is such a lack of enthusiasm for the current president.
I think that, you know, George is done and he feels like his term is over and he's counting down the moments for his departure. He's a lame-duck president at this point. But I think deep down, he's actually got some regard for Obama and is certainly going to, you know, do his best to make the process smooth. Was it awkward? I mean, these two have met before. They're seasoned politicians. If nothing else, his respect for Obama will have him get past any awkwardness. And they'll handle the task at hand and then say, you know, part and say their goodbyes. And George Bush will go on to hunt and jog in Crawford, Texas.
All right, Brandon, speaking of hunting and handguns and, well, of guns, not just handguns, there has been an interesting trend, and Allison Keyes at NPR did a fantastic piece this weekend on it, of enormous amounts of gun sales sort of in this transition period. Some buyers think that it might be more difficult to get certain types of guns after Senator Obama takes office, even some of the Obama supporters. But, you know, what's the significance? Is this something that's racially tinged? Is it purely about politics and the fact that Senator Obama is likely to put more restrictions or advocate for more restrictions? What's going on here?
To me, it's just purely political. And I wouldn't even say that there's an effort at this point to scare people. I think that effort has already been made. Traditionally, organizations like the NRA and Republicans in certain areas, usually the South, scare people into voting against their own interests. So in order to get people to vote against Obama, who's probably supporting a lot of their economic interests, they said, hey, he's going to take away your guns, or they distract them with abortion, or they distract them with all of these different issues that don't really affect their lives on a daily basis, so that they vote against their interests. So it was basically just another part of that machine that existed before this election, it probably still does, that distracts people from their real issues. And that's just a part of it. So they're buying guns because they're afraid that Obama's going to take them away, and he's not. There are so many other more important issues for him to focus on than whether or not someone in the rural South can own a firearm or not.
Well, Baratunde, there was that moment, and Senator Obama sort of went back and forth over whether he should apologize or how he should treat it, where he talked about people clinging to guns and God because they felt fearful. And so is there going to be some kind of a culture shift around gun ownership that is actually going to affect people, whether or not they want a handgun for protection or whether they're sports hunters or whether they just like guns, as some people do?
I think what would be concerning is if the attitude and atmosphere of fear itself ramps up. We've come out of 8 years of fear-mongering around otherness, around terrorism, around people taking away what's yours as far as certain cultural rights. What Obama has promised and what hopefully he'll be able to do is kind of keep us more aspirational and away from fear. There's something actually frightening about scared people buying up a bunch of guns. And it's not something we need when we're diving into perhaps the worst economic situation in 100 years. Those are the things that I worry about. And I think he can, if anyone could, set a tone where that fear isn't acted upon through, you know, massive action and purchase of arms.
And I don't think this is Obama's burden to bear. I think this kind of goes into what the Democrats, and I would say the American people as a whole, need to do, and that is communicate with people who, and it was an accurate statement when Obama said, people are bitter and they are angry, but they're angry at the wrong things. They're angry at the wrong people. If you live in a rural South, odds are, statistically, that you're less well off than people up north, or at least in the blue areas. And the reason for that is because corporate America has been taking advantage of these people. And rather than focus on corporate America, they focus on these non-issues. And it's not Obama's fault. I think it's our fault as progressives not communicating what the real problems and what the real sources of these problems are for the folks in these areas.
All right, Issa, I want to help transition us to another topic. And this is one that really has divided people across the country, even though it technically only applies in California. When voters went to the polls in California, the ballot included a referendum on gay marriage. Now, unlike other states where gay marriage bans passed, California had an active legal system where gays and lesbians could marry. And we saw a lot of people marrying right before Election Day just so they could know that they could do it. Now, these initiatives also passed in Arizona and Florida, but the issue there was much more theoretical. And you have a situation now where the New York Times, among others, has reported 70% of black folks in California voted for Proposition 8, which was for the ban, slightly more than half of Latinos, and also around half of whites. Some people are blaming Latino and African-American voters for the passage. What do you think about how this conversation has unfolded? What have you noticed, Issa?
Well, I think it's unfortunate that groups that could use opportunities and common histories, common struggles to form coalitions and work together, those opportunities are being squandered. It's not that different from the idea that, you know, lower-income whites vote against their economic interests when they are persuaded by the rhetoric of, you know, God and guns and abortion and all of that. I think what's interesting, however, is that as more and more members of Generation Y and younger people come of age and are able to vote, that these kinds of bans are going to be knocked down, and that civil unions or gay marriages are certainly going to be legalized in this country. I see that happening very soon. Gen Y has such a very different take on sexuality and sexual orientation than even Gen Xers and certainly baby boomers. The fluidity with which they define themselves and their relationships with men and or women is sometimes quite stunning to me, to be quite honest. But it's something that's very real that's coming out of their generation. And just as they've been the beneficiaries of the feminist movement and the civil rights movement, they're going to set a new tone for this discourse in the future. It's unfortunate that there is so much homophobia within our community, the African-American community, that people are unable to see gay rights and the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community as one that has actually shared interests with us. As shared members. And I think the fault really lies on both sides.
All right. Well, I want to make sure to that anyone just tuning in knows who we are speaking with on today's Bloggers Roundtable. This, of course, is NPR's News and Notes. And we were just hearing from Issa Yulin, who blogs at issayulin.com. We've also got Baratunde Thurston, who blogs for sites including The Huffington Post, and Brandon Whitney of Homeland Colors. We're talking about tensions between African-Americans and the gay and lesbian community that have started with Proposition 8, but may not end there. I mean, Baratunde, what struck me is that on our blog News and Views, this has been getting some of the largest number of responses. And people are, you know, people are angry, I would say on both sides, but there's never two sides to an issue. Some black people are mad we're being scapegoated. Some gays and lesbians are mad black people get it together. Some people are like, why didn't you go into black communities and, you know,
that's a big point.
Go ahead.
We've been having Jack and Jill Politics is sort of the primary place where I've put thoughts. And we've had a huge, probably record-breaking set of conversations and commentary from all sides around this. A couple of things have become very clear. One, the people who were kind of for the yes vote were extraordinarily well-organized, well-financed, and took nothing for granted. The people on the no side did the opposite of that in almost every possible way. And it seemed like there was an assumption made that California is a big blue state. We got this. And when it turned out that that wasn't the case, it was very much too late in the game to do any sort of actual cross-cultural, cross-urban outreach. And that assumption proved dreadfully false. The scapegoating charge is true. If you look at the actual numbers, my left wing, a blogger named Shanika, did some great math on how mathematically it's not possible, reasonable, or sane to sort of blame black people alone for this failure. Most importantly, we had one of our commenters, Michelle, who really, I think, nailed it when she talked about the era of the us versus them politics is not as effective as it had been before. And she had learned a lot from watching how Obama himself dealt with some of these situations, trying to cast these as universal all of us themes and not just gay, quote unquote, versus black, because that dynamic itself is a very unhealthy place to start a conversation.
And you know, I mean, I think the question as to whether or not blacks were the deciding factor in this vote is unimportant. I think the important question is how homophobic is our community? And I think if we're very honest about it, we're pretty homophobic. I mean, I grew up in Detroit, which is a mostly black area, and it never occurred to me until I actually got a chance to interact with people who are homosexual, how much homophobia affects their lives. So I think we really need to get to the root of it and bring it out into the open. We have a lot of Pharisees, I would like to say, people who use religion as an excuse to be bigots. And to and if we're going to get further as a people, we got our black president. We need to actually become the kind of people we needed during the civil rights movement, who were people who saw something wrong happening that wouldn't necessarily affect them and acted. And right now we feel as if we've gotten over and we've forgotten that there are people who are suffering just as we suffered. I mean, I don't know if it'll take two gay people jumping over a broom for us to really get it. But it's important that we recognize people's rights are being violated. And just like some Jews came down south because they recognized a parity during the civil rights movement to what they went through in the Holocaust, we need to recognize the similarities between us and a homosexual movement and do something.
Issa, who's going to build the bridge?
I think the youth are. I really do. I think that there's been a lot of division and fighting back and forth, and members of the gay lesbian community want to blame black folk, and black folk don't want to hear anything from the gay lesbian community. And I think that young people are thinking about race differently. They're thinking about gender differently. The only thing that seems to be really firmly in place is class for them. The class differences seem to be quite rigid. But these other dividers that have persisted for the past 400 years or so are really starting to disappear for younger people. And I think they're going to be the ones to really instruct the elders within both movements on both sides of the divide on how to shift the discourse forward and really come together. I love that point about African Americans being the people that we needed during civil rights and black power. I think that's right on the nose. And that's a good way to start that conversation.
Baratunde, I want to quickly transition to something that actually is connected to this. Roll with me here. We're talking about Senator John McCain and Governor Sarah Palin, his former running mate. And both of them have been talking to the media, but McCain went on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno to say that he really does not blame Sarah Palin for his loss.
I'm so proud of her, and I'm very grateful that she agreed to run with me. She inspired people. She still does. And look, I couldn't be happier with Sarah Palin, and she's going back to be a great governor, and I think she will play a big role in the future of this country.
Baratunde, one of the big questions that came up and that's still coming up in the kind of postmortem of the election is, do Republicans want a social conservative like Sarah Palin, who has much more her views on issues like abortion and gay rights are much more to the right? She's a social conservative. What have we learned about the Republican Party? Is Sarah Palin more like the future of the Republican Party, or is John McCain more like the future of the Republican Party?
I think what we learned is that the future of the Republican Party is completely up for grabs and uncertain right now. This party had successfully combined in some magical way neoconservative military aggressors with fiscal conservative, in theory at least, and on paper, many people, and social conservatives. And that coalition wasn't a natural one. It took years of nurturing and cajoling and influence, and it completely shattered under the weight of 8 years of George W. Bush and the rise of a pretty impressive political figure in the form of Barack Obama, plus some networked internet technology. So I don't think it's clear that McCain's the future or past or Palin's the future or past. I think that party's got a lot of inner searching to do to figure out just what it is it stands for and how it can coherently present that again.
All right.
I miss Lincoln's Republican Party. I want them to go back to their radical Republican roots where they weren't playing whites against blacks to get elected. Which is basically, to be honest with you, been their strategy for the last 25 years. So I would love to see a Republican Party that I wouldn't lose sleep voting for. I mean, I've been a lifelong Democrat, but it would be nice to when they win, not freak out because I'm afraid my country's going to be destroyed.
Issa, just quickly, do you think Sarah Palin will be a factor in 2012?
Oh, God, I hope not.
All right. Well, that's a quick answer.
Nice.
Thanks, guys.
Cosign.
All right. Issa Yulin is the author of the novel Crystal Morning. She blogs at issayulin.com. Baratunde Thurston blogs at The Huffington Post and Jack and Jill Politics. He was at our NPR New York studios. Brandon Whitney blogs at Homeland Colors. He also writes about politics for the websites Black Men in America and My Voice DC. He joined us from our headquarters in Washington. And you can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org.